One of the most remarkable aspects of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints is its unique history. Throughout the world, great stories from faithful church members have only added to that history. This program shares some of these incredible stories of faith, perseverance, hope, and inspiration. You're listening to Legacy. I'm your host, Nathan Wright. From her autobiography, Ruth May Fox wrote of her arrival into the Salt Lake Valley, "At last the long journey was ended. We had pulled up the hill out of Parley's Canyon just as twilight shrouded the valley. We could still catch a glimpse of the city below, but I confess to some disappointment as I asked, 'Did we come all this way for that?' This, however, was my first and last disappointment." We welcome to Legacy today Brittany A. Chapman, writer, presenter, and historian with the Church History Department. And before we get into today's discussion, so our listeners know a little bit more about you, please, Brittany, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Okay. I've worked for the Church History Department for about 2 years and am from St. Louis, Missouri. Now live here in Salt Lake. I first got Ruth May Fox is my great-great-grandmother, and I had heard about her all my life, and people were always proud of her as being our ancestor. But I really didn't know much about her beyond the fact that she was Young Women General President in the 1930s. And I got my master's in Victorian Studies at the University of Leicester in the UK. And while I was there is when I started getting interested in the life writings of Ruth May Fox, including her diaries. And she left quite a few diaries, and I studied those in writing my thesis. And just from there, her life became increasingly interesting to me. And her life writings will be published by the University of Utah Press in a couple of years.
Okay. Very good. As indicated, we're talking about Ruth May Fox today. And as you said, she's probably best known as the third general president of the Young Women Association. But there were lots of years and lots of experiences that brought her to that position.
Right.
Will you give us a kind of an early history of where she came from? What brought her here, et cetera?
Sure. She grew up in England, and as you read, she came across the plains to Utah in 1867, and she just started life in Salt Lake City and loved it. She married Jesse Fox Jr. in 1879, and they had a large family. She had 12 children, and sort of in as her children began to grow, she started getting more involved in the community. And her big step into the public sphere was by joining some women's clubs. The Women's Press Club, which was formed in 1891, was kind of her big step, where she really became good friends with Emmeline B. Wells. And Emmeline B. Wells was a very influential woman in Utah, and Ruth May Fox described her relationship with her as one of the kind of a mother-daughter relationship, and saying that she was the most influential woman in her life. And through the relationships that she made in the Utah Women's Press Club, she got involved in other causes, including suffrage, and that she was hugely involved with, and kind of a pivotal figure in spreading the enthusiasm of suffrage through women in the church, and was definitely influential in helping a memorandum to be put into the Constitution that would guarantee that women receive the vote in 1896.
Very good. We started this program with a quote, and this was her autobiography years later, and it almost sounds a little stark or caustic that she would say, "Did we come all the way for this?"
Right.
But if we couch it in the fact that she was 13 when she entered the valley. It makes a little more sense. Uh-huh. You know, here's a young teenager saying, "Are you joking me?"
Yeah.
Anyway, that's kind of funny.
Totally. Yeah.
Go ahead.
Oh, and I think coming from England, where there's well-established communities, it was still a rural town then. They had only been there for 20 years. And so I imagine it wasn't too impressive from the top of Parley's Canyon looking down.
My guess is there were probably a lot of teenagers who said
yeah,
that very same
so.
Thing.
Yeah, you don't hear that response very often.
So her demonstration of personal strength, and I'm not just talking strength of character, but actual physical strength, didn't end with her pioneer trek. What are some of the other things she ended up doing as she started from her teenage up through her adult years?
In 1898, she was called to be a member of the Young Women General Board, and that really involved a lot of traveling because the Young Women Presidency couldn't travel everywhere. They had what they called aides or members of the general board who would go out and visit the young women in outlying stakes and wards of the church. So, and travel was rough. She writes about her travel experiences in her diary, and it's really intense. So they needed her health, which she was kind of noted for, strangely enough, kind of her health and vigor of mind allowed her to go and visit these places.
If I may, there's a quote from a diary here. She said, this was in 1901, started for Vernal, Utah for Mutual Improvement Conference, went as far as Price, Utah, stayed all night with President Reuben Miller. In the morning, took the stage with Apostle Rudyard Clausen, riding about 60 miles, reaching a so-called station about half past 10 o'clock p.m., went to bed again, getting up at 2:45 a.m. and starting out again, making about 70 miles and reaching Vernal at 7 p.m. Continuing, she says, "I'm sure our best friends would not be able to recognize us as the roads were so dusty. I thought I should never be able to quench my thirst as we found no water on the way." So this was not just a 3-hour trip out the highway.
Right. Yeah.
This was really arduous, as it sounds like.
Yeah. And yet transportation was limited. They were dependent on stagecoaches, trains, whenever they ran and where they ran. And it was rural and difficult circumstances.
So as you mentioned, she married at age 19 to Jesse Williams Fox Jr. They had a large family and fairly prospered for a time. What were some of the hardships she had to deal with and overcome as that continued to shape this person, Ruth May Fox?
I think one hardship was providing for a large family. That was definitely a struggle, especially when economic times were difficult. And there were times when her husband wasn't able to provide for the family as well as they would like. They were economically well off at the beginning of their marriage through about 1893. And for those who might follow the economic history of the United States, you'll remember that there was a great financial collapse in 1893 that really affected her husband because he had a lot of investments in speculation. And when those kind of fell through, their financial stability was affected. And so that was a definite trial. There was a time that she and her children ran
Was it a boarding house?
Yeah.
You're searching for there?
Yeah, a boarding house. And the most favorable company wasn't always there. They only did that for a year before selling everything and realizing there's got to be a better way to do this. But they would often have boarders in their own home to make a little extra income.
So tell me, as you mentioned, she really did get involved in civic matters. Mm-hmm. Tell me about her philosophy in women's rights and women's education.
Okay. She was a huge advocate for education. She didn't have a lot of formal education herself, but she was really well-educated. And Susa Young Gates said of her that she was the peer of women who had the advantage of much more formal education than her. And she felt very strongly that every woman should make the most of herself in that area, and encouraged her daughters to be educated. And she felt like education was essential in helping a woman recognize her ability to contribute equally to society, equally with men in the workplace and in politics and in every other way. She's really forward-thinking.
Will you give us an overview of the actual responsibility she took, some of the organizations that she was involved with?
Yeah. She was involved in the Utah Women's Suffrage Association, which was created mostly to help the women in Utah to receive the right to vote, which they did in 1896. And that was kind of a big thing that she did. She was also involved in the international peace movement, which took place at the turn of the century. She was involved in, as I stated before, the Utah Women's Press Club, which the women's clubs were important at that time because they were kind of viewed as the middle-aged women's university, because not a lot of women had that formal education. But they got together and they wrote and they read and they read their works for each other to get critiques and to improve. And it was a really stimulating intellectual environment for them. They debated topics, and so that helped them progress. She was also involved in the Reapers Club, and both those associations helped her to grow.
When I think of women's suffrage and some of these other causes, besides reviewing each other's writings and talking amongst themselves, I think of some of the pictures with the mm-hmm. protest signs and some of the other stuff. What did she actually do? Was she involved in stuff like this?
Or? Well, I think the history of women's suffrage is really interesting and different from any other place in the country. Women in Utah did have the right to vote in 1870, and it was unanimous in the legislature. There was nothing that women had to do to fight for the right to vote, which is really remarkable. And perhaps it wasn't a reason for that was because voting had always been a part of Mormon culture. Women would vote equally with men in stating church leaders. And so it might not have been seen as anything different from what they had been experiencing before. But as time passed, the federal government was concerned about the huge population of the Mormon vote in Utah and thought, okay, one way to decrease Mormon power will be to take away women's right to vote, which they did through the Edmunds-Tucker Act in 1887. And so that took away women's right to vote. And that, as you can imagine, did not go over well. And so it's kind of from that time that women started putting forth efforts to get the vote back.
Reminder to our listeners, you're listening to Legacy on the Mormon Channel. We're talking today with Brittany Chapman, a historian with the Church History Department, and we're talking about Ruth May Fox. It seems we have two lines here that Ruth May Fox sort of went down, which was church leadership and involvement and the civic side of things.
Right.
Did they overlap very much, and was there ever any problem with the two?
I don't think so. I think she always saw her purpose as one, and that was to advance the cause of women, to advance equality, and to increase testimony in young women. And that was her motivation. I think she was always gospel-centered in what she was doing, even in the public sphere.
So you say that Ruth May Fox remained active even after her release from the Young Women Association.
Definitely, yeah.
What, I mean, for a woman who active pretty much describes her, how, uh-huh. what does that mean that she remained active after this?
She never stopped. She was always contributing to her community. She would often speak places, and one of her mottos was think young, be young. She was always thinking and improving her mind and writing poetry, reading, learning new things. She had a large family, so she was very involved in their lives as they grew. And because of her remarkable life and contributions, she was always in demand to be places and speak places. And she was really a gutsy lady, whereas many women might have been afraid to travel places. She was not. Even at the age of 103, just a year before her death, she was flying on airplanes to go visit her children in California, and just remarkable. She never stopped.
I'm quoting you as part of quoting your grandmother. It was part of her purpose to educate women, to help them feel greater freedom, and that equality among the genders would be an entrance into that golden time upon which the best thoughts of the ages have been centered. Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit more about this philosophy she had.
Okay. I think she was always looking towards with the gospel as her focus. She was, I think in that quote, she's talking about the stage of life when we eventually reach the millennium. And certainly then, I believe that she thought there would be equality of the genders, and there wouldn't be a disparity like they were experiencing there, where women didn't have the same rights as men and couldn't contribute in the same ways to society as they could.
Thank you. I think another thing that maybe some people may not realize, unless they look at the bottom under the hymn, mm-hmm. is that your second great-grandmother is the writer of the lyrics for the hymn Carry On.
Right.
Will you please
yeah.
tell us that story?
You bet. She, in 1930, it was the centennial of the organization of the church, and every year there was a June conference. And at this time, she was the Young Women General President. So for June conference, the youth were all gathering, and they wanted a really rousing hymn that the youth of Zion could sing. And so they had people submit ideas for songs and to kind of rally the masses. And they didn't receive any that really hit the mark. And so Ruth said, well, it looks like I'm going to have to write something. And you'll remember that she was a great poet and had already composed a couple of hymns, at least the text for the hymns earlier. And so she thought, okay, let me see if I can compose the text for this. So she began writing the text for Carry On at noon, and came back a few hours later with it complete, as you can read it now in the hymn book. And she said it just flowed and came so easily that it had to be divinely inspired. And she asked Alfred Durham, who was a composer, to write the music for the hymn. And when she heard it, she said, oh, that's just what I hoped it would sound like. And it's a very energetic piece. And the way it was first sung was pretty impressive. So on June 8th, 1930 is when the conference was. And the entire lower section of the tabernacle was reserved for the young men and women. And they were all provided with gold and green flags, which were the colors of the Mutual Improvement Association. And when the chorus came, which you'll remember is Carry On, and talks about holding aloft their colors. They march in the glorious dawn. O youth of the noble birthright, carry on, carry on, carry on. And it was at that point where they raised their golden green flags and literally held aloft their colors. And she writes in her autobiography that, to say that I was thrilled to hear an army of young men and women vocalizing the pledge to continue the work of their noble fathers is to express my feelings mildly. She wrote when she was about 100 years old that she felt like she was better known as the author of Carry On than any other of her achievements over her life.
And how did she feel about that?
I think with the if people would remember the message, I think she was very proud of that. Yeah.
Definitely one of the most loved hymns, I believe, in the church and especially among the youth. There's a lesser-known poem associated with the Hawaii temple.
Right.
And with the that rededication, it seems to have come up again. Can you tell us about that one?
Sure. The Hawaii temple was announced in the October 1915 General Conference. And Joseph F. Smith announced it. And you'll remember that he, as a young man, he served a mission there and was very attached to the Hawaiian people and so was thrilled when it seemed to be the right time to build a temple there in Hawaii. And this would be the first temple outside of North America. And I think that was a thrilling concept to the saints. It was the first temple brought to the people, which is a huge emphasis of what we're doing now. And so when it was announced, Ruth May Fox wrote a poem, and I imagine her just maybe sitting right there in conference and starting to compose the lines in her head, or jotting it down shortly after she got home. And it was published in the December 1915 Improvement Era, and that magazine must have made its way across the seas, because shortly thereafter, a missionary on the islands named Orson Clark composed music to the poem that she wrote. And President Joseph F. Smith came and visited the islands in just a few months after making that announcement in the General Conference. And the saints in Hawaii greeted him singing the song, and he was so moved by it that he asked for a copy of the music and brought it back with him. And in April 1916, so just 6 months after he originally announced it in the building of the Hawaii Temple in Hawaii in October, he had a quartet sing a temple in Hawaii. And so that was kind of thrilling for Ruth to hear her song sung in General Conference. And the saints loved the song so much that it was sung at the 1919 dedication of the Hawaii Temple. And that was, in fact, kind of forgotten, a song that was lost over time. And finally, in Dean Ellis, who lives in Hawaii, was researching the first temple dedication in anticipation for this new one that's coming up on November 21st. And he found that a temple in Hawaii was sung, and he thought, wow, what's this song? And started researching it and found all the history about it and was able to tell the people who are planning the temple rededication celebrations about the piece, and their 1,000 youth chorus is going to be singing it at a celebration the day before the dedication. So that's really exciting.
Wow, very exciting.
Yeah.
As I've done the research for this interview, there's a very striking picture of your second great-grandmother. This is radio, and so we can't see the picture. Would you please describe that picture of your grandmother?
I love this picture. It was taken of her just after she was called to be a member of the general board, and her head is kind of cocked to one side, and she's wearing kind of a boa with a beautiful dress, and she just looks very strong, and you can see an impassioned leader who loved the rights of women in her face. There's definitely a core of character there, and I love this picture.
It's amazing just looking at that picture.
Yeah, you can see a lot of who she was in that picture, I think.
What else do we need to know about Ruth May Fox?
She's definitely been an example to her posterity. And I think just the power of a well-lived life has definitely influenced me personally and her children and grandchildren and on. As far as her life and the events in her life, I think what she would want people to know most about her is her testimony. Her testimony was her most valued possession, and her life motto was the kingdom of God or nothing. And she really lived that every day. And I think for her, being a good, faithful Latter-day Saint was the most important thing. And I think she would want that to be remembered about her, and that her life actions were consistent with that testimony.
Why don't you go ahead and read Ruth May Fox's testimony for us?
Okay. She left a short testimony for her posterity, and it's powerful in its shortness and in the life that she led. She writes, "Ever since I could understand, the gospel has meant everything to me. It has been my very breath, my mantle of protection against temptation, my consolation in sorrow, my joy and glory throughout all my days, and my hope of eternal life. The kingdom of God or nothing has been my motto."
Wow.
Yeah. Pretty powerful.
I think how through TV, radio, and print, along with in-person ministration, today's church leaders are known to the membership of the church. How did Ruth and other leaders at the time accomplish nearly the same thing?
They had several publications, and one of them was the Young Women's Journal, and that kind of went out to the young women of the church, and so they would hear the words of their leaders that way. There were also newspapers. The Woman's Exponent was a woman's newspaper that lasted past the turn of the century, and then eventually there was radio. But I think before radio, I think the journals and newspapers were the way that people got to know their leaders.
And so we've talked about some of Ruth's travels, and you've mentioned a European tour that she took with some church leaders. Tell us more about that.
Okay. In 1937, there was what they called the Centennial Tour of Europe, and 1937 was the 100th anniversary of the first baptism in England. They wanted to go and place a memorial plaque at the River Ribble near Preston, where the first baptisms took place. And in the meantime, they took a trip all over Europe. And that was something that Ruth was invited to go to, and she was just thrilled when that opportunity came, because she didn't think she would ever be able to go back to her native land of England and revisit the places that she knew as a girl. And she kept a little travel diary at that time and wrote about how things hadn't changed in Bradford-on-Avon, where she lived, and And then it was just like she remembered. And she just loved seeing all these different places. It was really interesting to me while I was going to school in England. I got to travel to Bradford-on-Avon, where she was born. And it was really a neat experience to realize that she had lived there as a young girl, and that her ancestors had lived there, and my ancestors, and there's nothing quite like that experience. And also in her little travel diary that she kept, she visited lots of different places in Europe, and it was really neat to kind of to look at her diary later and realize we had been to a lot of the same places in Europe without me even realizing it. So that was kind of cool too.
To put this trip a little more into perspective for our listeners, who was traveling with her?
Okay. Most of the leaders of the church were with her, including President Heber J. Grant. A number of apostles were with her, and seven women from the general board, including the Young Women General Presidency at the time, which consisted of Lucy Grant Cannon, who was President Grant's daughter, and Clarissa Beasley, who was her second counselor. And it's good to remember that in 1937, she was in her 74th year. And so this was no small feat for a woman her age, but they said that she was just as sprightly, if not more so than any other person in the company. And it was kind of laughed about that one of the women who was a decade or more younger than her said, "I'm so tired, I don't think I'll be able to get out of bed." And Ruth said, "Well, maybe someday I'll feel that way." But she just kept on going.
We've talked about a lot of the civic things that Ruth did through her years. Specifically, she spent some time with the National Council of Women.
Right.
What did she do with that organization?
She began in the National Council of Women as a representative for the Young Women Organization, which was then called the Young Ladies Mutual Improvement Organization. Well, actually, which was then called the Young Ladies National Mutual Improvement Association. I'll say that one more time. The Young Ladies National Mutual Improvement Association. And she represented their interests on a national level. And the National Council of Women was United Women's, was a central organization for women's clubs. And they were united in their interests for women's rights and women's causes. And so she was a part of that, and was auditor of the organization for many years.
So we know she was the general Young Women president.
Uh-huh.
How did her involvement with young women get started?
Okay.
Very early on, and how long did it last?
Right. Okay. She received her first calling in Young Women in 1895 as a leader in her own ward, and worked with the young women there. And then she became a member of the general board in 1898, and her involvement with young women lasted over 40 years, and her involvement on the general level was almost 40 years. She was the first counselor in the Young Women General Presidency for many, many years. From 1905 until she was called to be general president in 1929. And then she was released as general president in 1937. So almost 40 years on the general level.
My, oh, my.
Yeah.
She was a very busy woman.
Yes, she was. Shortly before her release, she wrote a letter to President Grant, and it was just before her 84th birthday. So, and the young women of the church would have been celebrating her 84th birthday. And she said to President Grant, "My birthday will be celebrated abroad, And I'm sure it will be a subject of much discussion that the leader of a young women organization is turning 84. And she said, I am not asking for a release, but I stand in readiness whenever you deem it advisable.
84 years old leading the young women.
Yeah.
That's remarkable. That's quite remarkable.
Which leads me to correct myself. She was 84 years old when she went on the European tour.
Okay. Wow. That was amazing.
Yeah.
When you describe her life as well-lived, I think the fact that she stuck with so strongly that philosophy of her testimony in the kingdom of God basically describes well-lived.
Yeah, I agree.
I believe on this program we've talked about the History Department's project, Women of Faith in the Latter Days.
Yeah.
I saw your name associated with that. Tell us a little bit more of what that's about.
Okay. Deseret Book is publishing a 7-volume series called Women of Faith in the Latter Days. And it's meant to answer a need that I think we have in the church for the stories of faithful, righteous women to be told and accessible. Because if you think about, well, if you were in a Sunday school class and the teacher asks you to write on a piece of paper in one column the men in the history of the church that you knew, and then in another column the women in church history that you knew, I don't think there's any doubt that we know more men than women, which is a real shame and definitely should be changed, because their lives of faith they carried on the tradition of their beliefs. They instilled the gospel into their children, and it's essential to tell their stories. And the series is exciting and different because we're asking for submissions from people to submit their stories of their ancestors, people that are lesser known. We want to include a good mix of people that are well-known women in the church, and then those that aren't, who might be famous in their families, but nobody else knows their stories. It's been forgotten. And we're especially looking for their personal writings, like diary entries, letters, autobiographies, those sorts of things, because they can tell their story better than anyone else. And we want them to be able to speak and share their own voice. So that's the purpose behind the series. Each volume will publish a volume annually. And the first will come forward in 2011. And it will feature women born before or in 1820. And then each volume will follow 25-year increments in birth year after that. So volume 2 will be 1821 to 1845, and then on like that. So submit if you have any if you have any ancestors that have left behind good writings and have great stories to share.
So we all love to tell stories about our ancestors,
right,
but you're looking for specific personal diaries and personal voice type things to help.
Yes, if available. I mean, if you feel like there's a great story to tell that they might not have told in their own words, but there's some well-documented sources that you can refer to, then that might work. But we really want to get away from the myths that have been passed on.
Sure.
Because that happens, and we don't want to perpetuate those. The Spirit only bears testimony of the truth, and so we want the truth to be told.
So I would expect Ruth May Fox will end up in one of these volumes, although she was born in 1853, so
right,
a little bit down the line,
right,
we should see her.
Yep, volume 3. We're excited for this to come forth.
So as I understand it, the submission deadline for the first volume has come and gone.
You're right. So we have all the chapters right now for volume 1, and we're preparing them.
I see.
Yeah.
Excellent. Well, today we've been discussing the life of Ruth May Fox with her great-great-granddaughter. Brittany Chapman. And Brittany, thank you very much for being here today. This has been very enlightening and
it's a pleasure.
Very fun.
Thanks for having me.